All right, we'll get started. Does anybody remember what we've been studying the last couple of weeks?
Prophecy.
Preterism.
Okay, preterism. Okay, and so we have written up here, preterism, it's already happened, right? It's in the past, okay? Today we're going to talk about historicism, okay, which is another method of interpreting, or kind of a, I think hermeneutic is not quite the right word I want to use for it, but there's four main ways of looking at Revelation and prophecy in general. You have preterism, which we've been looking at, historicism, idealism, and futurism. Okay? And so this is our second one we're looking at. And to a large extent, I would say this one is probably the more neglected in a lot of modern futurist churches. Okay, and I kind of qualify us as that because I know that's the way that we've, most of us in this church have been taught over the years. And it, just in general, is from knowing many of you, is I know the generally held viewpoint. Historicism is probably the interpretation method that's least discussed amongst Christian people today, except for those who hold this viewpoint. And this is just my analysis, of course. So, I mean, you can prove me wrong probably pretty easily. But a number of the study guides and teachers that I've utilized as some of my source material as I've studied this, they neglect talking about this viewpoint altogether. They just kind of, they talk about preterism, they talk about idealism, they talk about futurism. This one they kind of leave out. And I could leave it out too. In fact, the last time I did this, I did. But I think there is a lot of important information for us to learn in understanding this viewpoint. When I went to school, I loved history class. Okay? I really enjoyed history. It was easy for me. But it wasn't until I went to college and took History of Western Civ. And I took it out of order, so I took History of Western Civ from 1600 to present first, and then I took Western Civ from Egypt up to 1600. I don't know why I did them out of order, it's just how it fit in my schedule. But what became so much more clear to me in those classes in college than had ever been in middle school and high school, where history was a lot about dates. Okay, it was this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened. But when I got to college and we started laying it all out, it was like, this happened, and then therefore this happened. And then therefore this next thing happened. And suddenly history wasn't just a bunch of events on a timeline, but instead there was a lot of cause and effect. And there was a lot of just eye-opening understanding of why the world is the way it is and why things are the way they are, how they got there, what people were thinking at those times, and how that influenced the decisions they made when their time came along. And as Christians in this modern world, we're really, really bad at church history. Okay? We're not really good at it. We don't spend a lot of time thinking about it. And yet, there's so much we could learn about how we got to where we're at and why we're having the various debates we have today if we'll take a little time to understand some church history, understand what people were thinking then, and not look back on our predecessors as just somehow being really unfortunately very ignorant because they don't know all the things we know today. Okay? And so that's why I think we should spend a little time understanding this hermeneutic and what it has led to today, how we got to where we're at today. Its influence on it is substantial. So this lesson is going to be a little bit more boring on history side probably than usual, but it's, I think, going to set us up for some important understanding about eschatology in general, Revelation, why I choose not to follow this viewpoint, etc. So, for all of you history buffs, today should be exciting. For those of you who don't like history, well, fuck it up. So here's a name. Yes, no sleeping back there, Ann. I know the gym teacher's like, history. Okay. Joachim Fiore. Okay. He lived 1135 to 1202. Okay, and so obviously this is pre-Reformation. And he decided that he was that history of the world could be divided into three parts. And he qualified though that division as being representative of the Trinity. So he divided history into the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And you can probably presume that he quantified the Old Testament as the era of the Father. And he quantifies now, from Christ to now, to the present, as the era of Christ, or the Son. And that the future would be the era of the Holy Spirit. Now, you see when he lived? So, he thought that he was right at the end of this time, that it was almost over, that the future was at hand. And one of his main textual citations for that was that in Revelation, it talks about 1260 days. Is anybody familiar with that? What's that referencing?
49 weeks.
How many years is... It says 1260 days, right?
Yes.
3.5 years. Okay, and so for a futurist, when we read the book of Revelation, we look at that as it is talking about the tribulation and the great tribulation, 1260 days and 1260 days. He saw 1260 days being equivalent, so days, to 1260 years. Well, you see where he was at? So he believed that this was going to begin in 1260 AD. Okay, and that's when the new age would begin, was in 1260 AD. Now, right away, I think one of the important and interesting things we can take from this is that the allegation that it's only futurists and only pre-tribulationists or whatever like to pick days is kind of undermined by this idea here, okay? And as we'll see throughout some more of our study, this idea that we can take Revelation and take a bunch of historic stuff and then overlay it and say, see, it's happening here. See, this verse is right here, is something that the church and the Christians have been struggling with for a long time, okay, or have been prone to do for a very long time. But he looked at the era that he lived in, and now is when we're going to branch into a little bit more history that I think is fascinating. Let's see how much you know. Any of you hear the products of Catholic school? Anybody here go to Catholic school besides my kids? No? All right. See, if any of you know, I don't think they would teach you this at Catholic school. Does anybody know the significance of this word? No guesses? How many popes are there? One. Where does the Pope live?
Rome.
Except for when he lived in Avignon. Okay? And so, little interesting church history.
There are times there have been two popes.
Actually, there's more than that. Three. So, prior to Mr. Fiore's time, up until about, I think, if I remember the date right, I think it's about 1160. The Pope had really kind of existed in Rome, the Bishop of Rome, etc., from about the 5th century. Okay? But he was the Bishop of the Church. And, of course, you're familiar with the Great Schism when the East Church and the West Church split up later on. But you had the Pope in Rome, and he was a church leader. Okay? And for good, for bad, the problems they had, we could go into a lot of that. But he was a church leader. And early in the 1100s, the Pope was kidnapped. Okay, the Lombards kidnapped him. Okay, and that's a group of Italians. So the Lombards kidnap him, and a king came to rescue him named Pepin the Great. He rescues the kidnapped Pope. And in order to protect the Pope, he creates the Papal States and builds a concept, in a sense, that the Pope is in a buffer zone, a safety zone, okay? Papal States. And this is where we see the significant transition of the Pope being the leader of a church to being the leader of a country. Moving, and we just use these terms are generalizations, but and move the Pope from simply being a moral leader to a political leader. So we move from one step to the other. And as the Pope was granted these states and this political power, you know, he starts declaring certain kings more legitimate than others. He declares, you know, the Holy Roman Empire, the Holy Roman King. Charlemagne gets to gain that title early, right? And so we see the Pope moving from just a head honcho at a church to being the head honcho of a kingdom. And he raises an army. And so what happens soon after this? Speaking of armies, what happens?
Crusades.
And the Crusades did what for the Catholic Church? Anybody know? Money. Big money. Okay? So as the Pope raises this army, gets all these knights and these various kings to pay tribute to him because he establishes their legitimacy, and he sends them off. The church starts to hold on to lands in kind of an escrow while the knights are out fighting the Pope's wars, and they don't come back. And the church just starts raking in more and more property, right? The women weren't allowed to own the property. The church held it then. And so more and more the church became more and more powerful. And what happens? What do we always say about power?
It corrupts.
Okay. And so the papacy, we can go back prior to this time and see other problems they were having with sexual abuse and things like that were real. There's a pope prior to this who, you know, it's just really some disgusting, very disturbing histories of some things that happened within the church. Part of what drove the church eventually to say that priests and the Pope needed to be celibate. There's a lot of history here, okay? Just tons and tons of history. But it's starting to come to this huge, roaring problems. And so after this, then, as power came up and the papacy generated more and more power, there started to be contention over who got to be pope, right? Now everybody wants to be pope, okay? And so there's battles and wars, and so all of a sudden the papacy moves to Avignon in France. And the king of France is taking care of the pope, basically, and protecting him because of all the violence in Italy. And so you have 70 years of the pope in Avignon. Now stick with me now. I know that you're like, why are we doing all this history? What's this have to do with the book of Revelation? Okay, I know. But it's important to lay some out of how this all came about. Okay, so the pope was exiled to Avignon 70 years because he was in France, and the other countries were in wars with France, including now England's in the Hundred Years' War with France. People were like, well, the pope just always defends France, and he never defends anybody else. And so no matter what the French king does or the French army does, they're doing God's work. The rest of us aren't doing God's work. And so bitterness starts to raise up between other countries, between the Holy Roman Empire and France, and France and Britain, etc., etc. And so there's tensions. So now what happens at the end of this 70 years, when a pope dies, and I can't remember the name of the particular pope, but Rome elects a pope, and Avignon elects a pope. And now we have two popes, one in both places. And that goes on, and then one of those popes dies, so they elect another one. And some people don't like that one, and they elect a third pope. So now we have three popes at one time. One in Avignon, one in Rome, and one who's exiled and running around all over the other places trying to hide out from the other popes. They're all excommunicating each other, declaring anathemas on each other. Okay? It's a huge mess. All right, and so then finally, the sides come back together. Avignon is canceled, and the popes move back to Rome, back under one pope. And that happens in the late 1200s. So you have all this drama, you have all this corruption, and you have a loss of moral authority because of the corruption. You have the Crusades bringing in this money and getting too much power. And so our friend here, Mr. Fiore, he's living in this time period as these things are just having happened. So remember, he's 1135 to 1202. He sees 1260 coming, and he's thinking, this is the end times. This whole book of Revelation is about to be fulfilled. We're going to hit the year 1260, and I've got all this drama all around me. And so he starts taking the book of Revelation, and he breaks down the events that are happening. He says, this is reference to this event, to this event, to all the things that are happening. Now, he was Catholic, because that was it. There wasn't, you know, somewhere else really to be unless you were a nonconformist, and those people got burned at the stake. So he was still in the Catholic Church. So he stopped short of saying that the Pope was the Antichrist. But yet, he identified some of these popes in all that distress when there were two and three popes, that some of them were the Antichrist. And that all this turmoil was a fulfillment of Revelation. So he was, when he published this, when he taught this, the rest of the world around, like I said, they were already mad, right? England's mad at France. Holy Roman Empire, which is Germany, is mad at France too. Everybody's upset. And so he starts teaching this, and some people are like, this really fits. This makes sense. This helps me explain the turmoil of the world around me. And so it wasn't shortly thereafter that St. Francis comes on the scene. And St. Francis, who started the monkish order, the Franciscans, he liked this teaching. So he adopted this teaching and told it to his monk followers. And one of his followers, I'm going to run out of room on this board, so you'll have to forgive me for that. But one of St. Francis's followers is a man named Nicholas.
Cage.
No. Nicholas of Lyra. And he lived from 1270 to 1349. And Nicholas of Lyra took these early teachings of Fiore and published them into a book. He wrote a commentary on the book of Revelation that took all of these happenings, all the papal indiscretions, all the wars and battles, and he took them and put them into the book of Revelation. He overlaid Revelation like you could with a transparency, right? And he said, here's where this happened. He laid out like the locusts that the book of Revelation talks about as being the Muslim hordes that swept over the Western civilization in the years 700 through 800. He took the various crusades and put them into these as being different battles. He took the different pope problems they were having and all of this. So he really started to lay it out in great detail. But I should have started with this, so you'll have to forgive me for being a little out of order. Because you can say that, well, that's kind of crazy. Why is this guy so important? And now we'll test Dave's knowledge here, since he's the doctor among us.
Love you too, Ed.
Are you familiar with this term? And I might spell it incorrectly because I couldn't find it.
Something about four.
Yes.
What?
Quadriga. So up to this point, up to Nicholas of Lyra, this was the prevailing hermeneutical method for understanding the Bible, the Quadriga. And the Quadriga said that every Bible passage had to be interpreted in four different ways. Mm-hmm. And that you had to understand those, that there was a mystical interpretation, an allegorical, a anagogical, and a literal. Okay. This was a prevailing teaching of the Catholic Church up to this point was that every Bible passage had to be interpreted four ways, which kind of made it impossible for just lay people, right? First, it wasn't a language you didn't understand. You didn't have copies in your language. And then it's like, which interpretation am I supposed to understand here, right? Nicholas of Lyra, the amazing thing that this man did was that he said this should come before all other methods of interpretation. Literal interpretation, the plain textual version, the plain sense is the right way to understand the Bible, except for the book of Revelation. So, this is really a notable part of church history right here, is that we should understand the Bible in its plain literal sense. This is how we interpret the Bible. When it's literal, when it can be understood literal, we say it's literal. Okay, but he was unwilling to give that to the book of Revelation. So he wrote commentary on the whole Bible, all 66 books. It's really interesting. He, they didn't have the printing press. He wrote his, he took big pages. You'd have a big page, and he'd put the Bible page in a box in the middle, and then everything else around it was Bible commentary. It's really amazing what he did. A lot of work. And he used the literal method for 65 of the 66 books. But when he got to Revelation, no. So we have a lot to thank Nicholas Lyra for, in the sense of moving the times, moving the church, moving this, his commentaries that, and this is why this is critical, his commentaries were extensively used by the church reformers. Who knows what year the Reformation began? 1500s is right. Anybody know the exact date?
1530s?
1517. All right, 1517, right? With the what?
What's 95
with the 95 Theses of Martin Luther. Okay, and so Martin Luther and Calvin and so many of those other reformers, this guy here is who they look to. This guy had written this massive Bible analysis, and he had used the literal method. He said, forget these other ones. Don't use them unless there is no other way to understand that passage. This is how we read the Bible. Martin Luther thanked Nicholas of Fiore for helping him to come understand the doctrine of justification of faith. Because you read it in Romans under the literal sense, you can't come to any other conclusion than what Martin Luther came to conclude. Right? That we are the just are saved by faith, and that faith through Christ. Okay? And so this man was huge, huge influence in the Reformation and in how the church got to where we are today. But that influence then also very much extended to how the reformers understood the book of Revelation. Because they used his book extensively to understand all the rest of the Bible. It motivated them, it excited them, it gave them a passion for Christ and for the church. And so they just grabbed onto how he interpreted Revelation as well and ran with that. It is a huge part of how we got to where we are today. Is through Nicholas of Lyra and his writings. So, how did he see Revelation? He saw it as a continuous book of predictions that led up to his time. Okay? He saw the apostolic age as, you know, the beginning part of Revelation, the reign of Domitian, the fall of Jerusalem, then the fall of Rome. He identified all of these as specific events that Revelation is referencing through its symbolism. The great schism of the church, the papal problems that I talked about earlier, the Crusades, etc., etc. And his view of all of that, how he laid that out, overlaying of history, then dominates all the reformers that came after him. Martin Luther, Calvin, Wycliffe, all of these are so dominated by that. And so what is kind of the, what, just knowing what you know now, what can you kind of see as the crux point of this worldview for interpreting Revelation? You can see then that the Pope is Antichrist. So as time ticked on, right, we passed up the 1260 mark, we passed up Nicholas of Fiore's time period. I mean, he's writing this before the Reformation. We get to Luther, we get to these others. And so they keep on saying, well, we had a view of Revelation where everything has taken place and overlaid in history to when that guy wrote his book, but now history has gone on 200 more years. And so then they take that overlay and they stretch it out and they fit new historic events. Some stayed the same. The Muslims oftentimes remained the locust horde, but other things changed, right? Other history happened, more wars, more drama, and so that historic view just kept getting stretched and stretched and stretched to fit it. But one thing that remained very consistent throughout that time was that the Pope and the papacy were the Antichrist. Waldo, who's another famous nonconformist, he said the Pope was Antichrist. Wycliffe, the Pope is Antichrist. Savonarola, if I can say that right, he identified not just the Pope as Antichrist, well, he was Catholic. So he didn't want to say the Pope himself was Antichrist, but what he said was that the Catholic Church had become the harlot of Babylon. And he lived right before the Reformation. He died right at the beginning of 1500. So this whole viewpoint, historicism, becomes very much the anti-Catholic interpretation. It becomes the choice of reformers everywhere, the viewpoint they take on. The beast and the Antichrist are the Pope. One of the interesting things that they did is that if you take the Latin for one of the names of the Pope, because he has many titles, but one of them is Vicarius Filii Dei, or what we often say in English, the Vicar of Christ, right? But this one here is a little bit more profound than that. It says that he's God, okay? So they kind of shied away from this title now, but this was a common title in this time period. And if you take this and write it into Latin and use Roman numerology and does anybody know what numerology is?
Assigning numbers to the letters.
Assigning numbers to letters, right? And so in Hebrew, when you count, you literally, there are certain letters that represent numbers at specific times, right? And if you all know in Roman, we still learn Roman numerals, right? I, X, V, D, L, right? That's 1, that's 10, that's 5, that's 500, that's 50, okay? So you take Roman numerology and you assign that to this, and guess what it comes out as?
666.
666. All right? You can use Hebrew numerology to take Caesar Nero and one of his titles, and you smash that together, and he comes out to 666 as well. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I bring that up because Christians today, especially futurists, get slammed for doing stuff like that, and they should be. I'm not, you know, whether it's Hal Lindsey or anybody else, when it was Trudeau's father for a while, somebody had taken his name up in Canada, and they equated it out numerology-wise, and he was 666. And somebody did it to Ronald Reagan. And if their name doesn't work, just add a title, right? Add president. If that's not quite enough, then add the president. You know, whatever you need to do. So numerology and that gamesmanship has been played for a long time. It's not new. It's been happening for over 1,000 years. But we can see, though, this is what they did to say the Pope is bad. The Pope is the beast. He's the Antichrist. And it became one of the huge motivators of the Reformed Church. Now, some other interesting parts of this. Luther, kind of our hero of the Reformation. And if you study him, you know, it's an amazing life and it's amazing what he did. You know, I don't want to take anything away from that. So Luther, he's taking on this man, Nicholas of Lyra's, viewpoints on the scriptures, on a literal interpretation, on scripture alone, sola scriptura, okay? But he's also familiar with how Nicholas feels about Revelation, and Luther comes out, and I'm going to read it specifically here so I don't get it wrong, so give me a second to bring it up. Okay. Luther says, about the book of Revelation of John, I leave everyone free to hold his own opinions. I would not have anyone bound to my opinion or judgment. I say what I feel. I miss more than one thing in this book, and it makes me consider it to be neither apostolic nor prophetic. He questioned its heavy use of visions. He says, first and foremost, apostles do not deal with visions, but prophecy in clear, plain words, like Peter and Paul and Christ. For it befits the apostolic office to speak clearly of Christ and his deeds without visions. And then he goes on to say, there's no prophet in the Old Testament who deals with visions. And this is where I kind of start to feel a little lost about Luther now, because like, well, did he miss the book of Daniel? Did he miss Ezekiel? But you can see that Luther says, let everyone think of it on his own spirit. My spirit cannot accommodate itself to this book. For me, there's not enough reason to think highly of it. Christ is neither taught or known in it, but to teach Christ is the thing which an apostle is bound above all else to do. So Luther basically was like, yeah, read it yourself. You know, he didn't like the book of Revelation. Calvin, who's a contemporary mostly with Luther, a little bit younger, came just slightly after him, but they overlapped and met. Calvin held that the book was primarily about the first century church, but also held that there was value to all the churches presently. So he was not so taken with the historicism viewpoint. However, he did agree that the Pope was Antichrist. So he kind of has a little bit of a sampling from both ways. Now, what can we... One last part of historicism that comes to play that's important to advance in this narrative. So we've got this, the teaching here. It started with Fiore. Lyra really lays it out for us, this whole idea of overlaying the book of Revelation on top of history, understanding the historical events. Where has this gone? And how did it deal with the second coming? These guys really didn't deal that much with the second coming. It still was in development until another famous theologian, Jonathan Edwards. So by the time we get to America, Puritans come to America. Remember, a pilgrim's land in 1620. Jonathan Edwards is mid-1700s, just before the Revolutionary War. This historicism remained the primary viewpoint of the Reformed Church. Both the nonconformists and the Reformed churches at this point primarily hooked on to this historicism viewpoint, as I said, because it was anti-Catholic. There was a tremendous amount of motivation to be anti-Catholic. And so Jonathan Edwards comes along, though, and he, being one of the most amazing theologians of his day, says, well, there's something missing here. And that's the idea of the millennium. Jonathan Edwards felt very clear that the Bible was very clear that there was going to be a 1,000-year of peace, of changed world. And he developed within this historicism framework. He is really one of the first to establish the post-millennial view. And this is really our first time getting to this point about the post-millennial, pre-millennial, amillennial viewpoints. And we'll have to talk about this more in the coming weeks. But he establishes and attaches to historicism the post-millennial viewpoint. I'm not going to go into that today. Okay, we are going to talk about kind of the three different ways of viewing the millennium. But I want you to know that the post-millennial view and where it's attached, whether it's in historicism or in futurism or anywhere else, that a lot of that comes very specifically from the teachings of Jonathan Edwards. He developed this idea and he attached it to historicism. So I want us to wrap up, though, as we talk about historicism and why I feel that the view has some problems. Troubles with this hermeneutic, this understanding, this way of interpretation. One, it doesn't take the literal sense of the scripture. Okay? It's a non-literal interpretation. And a lot of it's, I'm a literalist. You know, as much as is possible, I believe that we should understand the scriptures in their plain sense of the text, as much as is possible. I like what Alistair Begg says, right? The main things are the plain things, and the plain things are the main things. Okay? So I feel like this is kind of the crux of a lot of the historicism's problems, is that it's not taking a literal approach. Okay? The book of Revelation, when you read it, whether you're a preterist or a futurist, to those two schools of thought, it is telling us a narrative that is of a condensed time period. Right? I see it as primarily being, you know, especially after the letters to the churches, that it is there's 7 years that the events happen in rapid succession. Preterists see them happening in 3.5 years, in 66 AD to 70 AD with the fall of Jerusalem. This viewpoint says that the book of Revelation is stretched out. The historic tale that when it was first promulgated was only 1260 years, but is now over 2000 years. And what they would claim, how they fit the 1260 now, is that the historicist says, well, that's only referring to the 5th century to the 17th century, or really about the 18th, if you look at the dates, popes. And they'll cite a church council at the start of this one, and cite a church council here at the end of this one to kind of set up those 1260 years. They also use Daniel's time period in the same way. There's a reference in Daniel to 2300 days. They say that that's 2300 years. Part of the problem here with these, in my opinion, although it's also a criticism you can put onto the futurists at times, is that there's not a clear trigger for when you see days as years and when you don't. It's a bit selective in choosing when to do that. And speaking of that, then, there is more important than what I think more important point than this one, is that there's no objective rubric. And by that I mean, you try to overlay Revelation onto history, and you say this event is this in Revelation, this fall of this pope, this war, and then time goes by, and you sound like, well, there's another 500 years have been added on, so now we need to re-overlay and reassign these. And there's disagreement within the historicism interpretation over which event is attached to which thing in Revelation. And there's no objective rubric for determining which one is there, which one isn't, and as time goes on, it continues to stretch out. Another problem, then, is this is still referencing back to that earlier way of interpreting the Bible, right? Four different means of interpretation, the quadrica, which leaves pretty much nobody able to interpret the book of Revelation unless they have significant training. It's no longer a book for the people. It's no longer a book for the common person of God to be able to read. You have to have an enormous, inordinate amount of training to understand. So as an overall kind of analysis, I think that you can see historicism as agenda-driven. Okay, it's very driven by the agenda of who was interpreting at the time, to be anti-Catholic, to be anti-Pope, to be anti-whatever kingdom they didn't like, to be pro-kingdom they were in. It hinges almost entirely on Western history, kind of completely attached to Western history, and it's always changing as new history is added. Interestingly enough, I see two things happening with historicism that make it still very relevant to our time. One is, there's a particular church that is still very tied in with this. Does anybody know which one it is? It's the Seventh-day Adventists. This is their belief. Okay, this is where Mary Baker Eddy, She wrote a book about the future, the coming battle or something like that. I can't think of the name of it. But it is all this. And of course, she was from the 1800s. Okay? And like Jonathan Edwards and the Reformers and post-millennialism, which we will study more, they had a very distinctive view that things were getting better, that the church was militant and was going to reform the world and come into a golden age. Okay? And because she's so recent, the Seventh-day Adventists are still very committed to this viewpoint. The other is, and whether it's because of the internet or what, I don't know, but there's not really a name up here that I can ascribe to it, except to tell you that there is a strong movement out there right now amongst Christians to say, we want to attach ourselves to what somebody else used to believe. And so they look back to Jonathan Edwards, to the Puritans, or to John Calvin, or to others, and say, that's where I'm going to anchor my beliefs in eschatology. And so they look back and they find, and right now there's a significant move to follow the Puritans. They must have had it right. Okay? And so you'll find right now a number of new books that are published and other things that latch themselves onto historicism with very little justification, I'd say, beyond the fact that somebody else in history followed it, and they must be right. Because we want to avoid the controversies that I see in the church right now over eschatology, so I'm going to run back to a former view on eschatology from somebody who's not controversial about their other beliefs, so therefore they must be right on this one too. And we're going to spend some more time talking about that tendency, because it's not just here with historicism that that's happening. And we'll continue on with some of this discussion, but I hope you understand why I wanted to spend the day talking about this and why I laid out so much history, because I hope that you'll be able to draw some connections as we go ahead of seeing how interpretations are and struggles over interpreting the book of Revelation are not new. Okay, this isn't just a new problem. It's not just a Protestant problem. It's not just a futurist problem. These struggles of understanding Revelation have been going on for over 1,000 years. And the influence and trying to make it fit with where we're at right now led one of the guys I was listening to and studying with to say, the book of Revelation is almost kind of like a chameleon. Right? It kind of merges into the times and your viewpoints and what you want to understand. So, anyway, any questions, any thoughts, comments, quickly?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. It's interesting where we're at right now in the church, all the things that stand on the shoulders of so many people.
Mm-hmm.
But I was thinking about Calvin and Luther. I wonder if they thought Revelation shouldn't have been canonized.
So Martin Luther, who you might understand, was a man of very strong opinions.
Yeah.
There were several books that he was not really sure should have been in there. Revelation was one of them. He was pretty down on Hebrews and James. Not a big fan of those books. John Calvin wrote commentaries on every single book of the Bible except Revelation. And I think one Old Testament book, probably Nahum, as we studied before. Nahum was just not a lot there. So he wrote, but he did commentaries on everything, and then he didn't do Revelation. And this is something that I think we're going to try to ferret out a little bit more, is, and I thought John MacArthur had some really great perspective on this that I'll share with you as we get more into this, but eschatology, the study of the end things, is not unlike so many other church doctrinal issues, justification by faith, the Trinity, the deity of Christ, et cetera, that have gone through significant development, tension, push, pull, what's right, what does the Bible say, what does it not say, okay? And they've been through these tensions, and then you add to them the real life tensions that are going on in the world with the papacy, 3 popes, immorality, kidnappings, kingdoms, crusades, all of these things are all impacting the development of our faith and the understanding of what we believe. And so we're going to talk more about that, but we should not allow ourselves to be trapped into those who say that's only happening with end times, that didn't happen with any of the other doctrines of the church, because that's not true. They've all had to go through these maturations and better and poorer understandings and the tensions between them. History is important. History matters. All right, anything else? We are all out of time, so let's have a word of prayer. Dear Father, thank you so much for your word, for the opportunity to study it. We thank you that so many of your people who've come before us have also labored over these things, and that we have the privilege of standing on their shoulders, on standing on their work. Those who struggled so hard against corruption and the failures of others to bring us the truth and to protect the word. Father, help us to handle it rightly, to be wise and to study it in a way that pleases you. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.